KBrightBusiness.com to check out the KBright Business Directory for the best in the business.
It has a message for everyone.
It really speaks to my life.
AM 740, KBright.
Good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live again to take your calls if you have questions about the Christian faith, about the Bible, about just whatever you're curious about in those general categories. If you have a difference of a viewpoint from the host, then feel free to call about that as well. We have a line open for you right now at 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278 if you'd like to join us on the program. Our first caller today is Dave from Fountain Valley, California. Dave, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I just came across the fact that there is apparently a disagreement among scholars as when the Book of Revelation was written. I'd always heard it was around 95, and then there's some people say that it was 68, and then the people that have that disagreement say that the date of Revelation actually matters when it was written. I was wondering if you could comment on that, and I'll listen off the air.
Okay, sure, Dave. I appreciate your call. Okay, bye now. Well, the standard view through most of the 20th century among scholars was that Revelation was written during the reign of Domitian, probably around, as you say, 95 or maybe 96 A.D. This opinion fits well with just about any view of Revelation a person wants to take, with the exception of one view that would not accommodate that very well. Now, that view is the preterist view. The preterist view is the view that Revelation is predicting the destruction of Jerusalem in A.D. 70. At least that's the primary subject of Revelation. And, of course, if Revelation is predicting the destruction of Jerusalem in A.D. 70, then it could not have been written, 26 years after that time. You would not be predicting an event that occurred a quarter of a century earlier. And, therefore, it does matter to the person who holds the preterist view whether Revelation was written before or after A.D. 70. Now, there are two views, and there always have been, or I don't know if there always have been, but for centuries there have been two different views about the date of writing. A lot of scholars have thought throughout history that it was written during the reign of Nero, and others have felt like it's written during the reign of Domitian. If it was written in the reign of Nero, then Nero committed suicide in 68 A.D., and therefore, if he was the emperor at the time of writing, then the book must have been written no later than 68 A.D., perhaps earlier still, in his reign. And so many people think that the persecutions that are seen in the book of Revelation are descriptive of Nero's persecutions of the Christian. Others believe they're descriptive of Domitian's later persecution of the Christians. There are hints within the book that both sides use to support their view. On the side of those who take the early date, there is the fact that the number 666 can be harmonized with the name Caesar Nero more readily than with any other known person in history, in John's lifetime anyway, and that John did expect his readers to know the name that he's referring to, because he told them. He said, "You who have wisdom, let him, calculate or decipher this, the identity here of the beast. It's his number is 666. Decipher it." In other words, there was somebody that his audience could identify living at that time whose name could be reduced to the number 666 through the regular gematria process that was commonly done in languages that had numerals. Well, their letters of their alphabet were used for numerals. So it would appear that John had somebody in mind. It sounds like it was somebody who was currently living at the time, although not everyone would agree about that. And it was somebody that his readers could identify if they were wise, he said. And so who living in John's time could have had their name reduced to the number 666 other than Caesar Nero? There are no theories out there that I know of. There are a few other things that have indicated to some that the book was written during the reign of Nero and before the destruction of the temple. For example, in Revelation 11, 1 and 2, John is told to measure the dimensions of the temple because it was going to be given over to the Gentiles. The part that was not measured was going to be trampled on by the Gentiles. So it sounds like the temple was still standing, but in danger of being overrun by the Gentiles. And, of course, it was overrun by the Gentiles in 70 A.D., and if it was still standing when John wrote this, then it was written during Nero's reign instead of Domitian's. There are, on the other hand, external evidences for Domitian's reign. Particularly, Irenaeus made a comment that has been interpreted by most to say that John saw the vision on the island of Patmos near the end of Domitian's reign. That would be, you know, like 96 A.D., but not all understand Irenaeus' quote the same way. Some think that he's merely saying that John was seen by certain people that late in time, not that he saw the vision at that time. So there's ambiguity there. I don't usually use this program as an opportunity to pitch my book. I don't sell my book, but you can buy it through Amazon or ChristianBook.com or whatever. It's published by Thomas Nelson. It's called Revelation Four Views. There is a section in the introduction to the book that talks about the different arguments for and against the various dates. Generally, the Nero date or the Domitian date are analyzed there. My own view is that the early date has the most evidence in its favor, though it is not the majority view today. It was the majority view in the 19th century among Bible scholars, but it's not currently the majority view. A growing number of scholars are moving that direction, though, it would appear to me. And the people it matters to are the preterists, those who see something of a fulfillment of Revelation in 70 A.D. Of course, they have a stake in the date of writing. There are three other views of Revelation that don't have any concern about when the book was written. In other words, views that aren't looking for a fulfillment in AD 70 don't care when the book was written. The fulfillment they're looking for is beyond that, beyond 96 even. So that would be a brief answer to the question you raised, I think. Our next caller is Rick from Thousand Oaks, California. Rick, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you. The writers of the epistles, Paul and Peter and John and James, all seem to be ecstatically looking forward to Christ's coming or his appearing anytime during their lifetime. How could they, those who knew Christ best, have been wrong about that? Or were they looking for a different appearing or a different coming? I'd like you to kind of clarify that for me, and I'll get off the line and listen. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, thanks for your call. Well, just like the previous call, this has a relevance to preterists, because preterists, and by the way, I don't know these men who called. It sounds like someone set me up to talk about this, and I don't mind talking about it. It's just interesting that we get a couple calls in a row that bring this up. Preterists believe that we should recognize some places in the Bible which maybe are popularly applied to the second coming of Christ, and we should see those as not really intended to be talking about the second coming of Christ, but talking about something else, some near-term judgment act that they were referring to as the coming of the Lord. The reason for that is that the expression God coming or the Lord coming is found in the Old Testament as a reference not to literal coming of God, you know, in the sky, but really to, it's a figurative expression that speaks of God sending a judgment, usually just through ordinary means like armies from invading lands and so forth. These disasters coming upon some people in the Old Testament, if they were seen as a judgment from God, were poetically spoken of as if it was God coming to them and, you know, coming and beating them up, as it were. And the language of the New Testament uses the expression coming of the Lord, sometimes apparently that way as well. And so many people feel that when the New Testament writers were speaking about a near coming, for example, when Jesus said, some of you standing here will not taste death before you see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom, in Matthew 16:28, or when Jesus said that this generation will not pass before they see these things, and he had referred to the Son of Man coming, that these near-term references to the coming of the Son of Man, preterists believe, are referring not to the second coming, which is still in the future, but to something else which is poetically referred to as God coming, a judgment act. Usually, the event is thought to be the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Now, on the other hand, another alternative is that these passages you're referring to are talking about the second coming of Christ, which, of course, has not yet come, but that they hoped that it might, and they spoke of it as if they eagerly anticipated it. And if you say, well, how could people so close to Christ have made that mistake? Well, people can make that mistake. Christians at all times have anticipated that Christ might come in their time and wished that he would. As long as they don't affirm that he's going to, they're not really making a deadly mistake, a lethal mistake. I mean, if they only express hopes that he will come in their time, then that's just like Christians of every time have had those hopes. And there's nothing wrong with those hopes. Jesus had told them that the Son of Man will come at a time that you do not think that he will come. And it'll be like a thief in the night and so forth. So, you know, they would perhaps, with that kind of generalness of the prediction, have reason to hope that it might be in their lifetime. Although none of them committed to it. Certainly Jesus was the only one who committed to something happening in that generation, and while some of them had not yet died, in my opinion, I think his comments about that do refer to something else, like AD 70. But there are, in the epistles, lots of references to Christ coming, which I think are not about AD 70, and are not about anything that's happened even yet, that they are referring to the end of the world and the second coming of Christ, which we still anticipate. So I it's possible that they are referring to the end of the world, and they hoped it might be in their time, but they never said it would be. Paul and Peter and James and so forth never actually said that the end of the world would be in their own time. But they did speak of it as if it's closer than, like Paul said, it's nearer than when we first believed. And certainly, I think they exhibited a hope that it would happen in their own time, just as many modern Christian writers would show such a hope that it'll come in their own time. Vishal from Whittier, California is next. Vishal, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Good to hear from you. So my question, I have two
Thank
questions,
you.
And they're not really related to each other, but one question is about debt. And I wanted to get some insight on what the Bible approaches debt with, is it something that is more of a wisdom and folly type of approach, or is it something a lot more seriously a spiritual conditions related approach? And my next question is about Jesuits. Who are they? What do they believe about Jesus? And that's all I really wanted to know. So I'll go ahead and I'll let you get the rest.
Okay, your second question was about Jesuits, you say?
Yes.
Okay. I'll be glad to talk about that. Appreciate your call. That sounds like you may have hung up. Okay, well, the Jesuits were an order that arose in the Middle Ages to enforce the authority of the popes against dissenters. There were groups that were dissenting against the Roman Catholic Church, like the Waldenses and the Albigenses, and certain other groups that felt that the papacy was illegitimate and that many of the traditions of the Catholic Church should be abandoned. These people, in many cases, were saying a lot of the same things that Luther later would say. And Luther got away with it, but the Waldenses and some of these other groups, they didn't have the advantages Luther had. Namely, Luther had a printing press, and Luther had a king willing to hide him from the popes that were seeking to find him and kill him. People like Peter Waldo and the leader of the Waldenses didn't have those advantages, and so they were eventually, for the most part, silenced. But they were done so by an order that rose up within the Catholic Church called the Jesuits. They were very evangelistic. Most of the early international missionary effort that sprang from Europe was done by the Jesuits. Before there were Protestants, before there were Protestant missionaries, the Jesuits were in China and Africa and all over the world doing their missionary work. In fact, the movie The Mission, if you happen to have seen it, is about Jesuits in South America hundreds of years ago. The Jesuits were very missions-minded, but they also were the ones who established the Inquisitions, what we call the Spanish Inquisition, and there were other Inquisitions, which were where they would arrest people who were suspected of heresy or of basically deviating from the Pope's values and beliefs and his authority, and essentially torture them into submission or to death. And so the Jesuits sort of had a dark side to them, too. The Inquisition was conducted by the Jesuit order, and yet a lot of missionary work was done by the Jesuits too. So that's the Jesuits. I think their name means something like the Friends of Jesus or something like that. But in any case, it's just another order of within the Catholic Church, just like Franciscans and Benedictines and so forth are other orders within the Catholic Church. The Jesuits rose up specifically to defend the Pope's honor and to punish or reform people who were deviating from their loyalty to the Popes. Now, as far as debt is concerned, certainly debt is undesirable. You ask, is it just a wisdom and foolishness issue? For the most part, I think it is. It's a stewardship issue, too. One could argue that it's a moral issue in some cases. For example, if you fall into debt because you've been wasting, because you've been living a discontented life and living above your means, that is, God has provided enough for you to have food and raiment and housing, but you also have wanted a whole bunch of other things that you couldn't afford, and you go into debt with those, that's not just foolishness. I think that's violation of the command to be content with such things as you have. On the other hand, there are people who are so poor that to borrow is necessary for them just to get by. And Jesus said that his disciples should lend to anyone who asked them, expecting nothing in return. Now, Jesus is thinking, of course, of people in poverty who need food and clothing and necessary things. And you should have compassion on the poor, and you shouldn't lend to them with the idea that, well, they're going to have to pay it back. Or especially not with interest, because they're poor. But it's just an expression of your love for the poor and your recognition that the things you're using, the money and so forth, is God's, and you're stewarding it in his interest, not your own. So stewardship, contentment, these are moral issues because the Bible gives commands about them. But some people do fall into debt just out of necessity, in a sense, and God expects us to help them, to lend to them, and so forth. Now, if God actually commands his disciples to lend, then debt must not be a sin, since by lending to someone, you put somebody into debt. And certainly Jesus wouldn't want you to stumble somebody and make them sin. So debt is not itself a sin, but it does say in the book of Proverbs that the borrower is the servant of the lender. Meaning, of course, that the person who is in debt is not free until he has paid his debt. And that verse, by the way, is Proverbs 22:7. The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is a servant of the lender. So that's Proverbs 22:7. you don't want to be a slave if you can help it, and therefore you don't want to borrow. Also, like I said, much debt is the result of wanting to live beyond your means. Now, some people would say, and they may be right, that business debt is a little different than personal debt, in the sense that lending and even charging interest for someone who's taken out a business loan is not the same thing as charging interest from a poor person, because in Jesus' day they weren't capitalists in those days. They didn't go out and get a bank loan to capitalize a business. People just inherited their parents' businesses, or else they'd earned money and started their own businesses. But the banks, I don't think, would capitalize businesses in those days. So lending was simply a matter of helping people out who were in need. And that's a little different than the modern idea of someone borrowing money from a bank to start a new business or something. It's an entirely different thing. Whether that should be done or not, I guess, would have to be decided on other bases that I'm not really sure what the scripture would say about that specific thing. The Bible does say that we should steward God's money well, that we should be content, even if we have only food and raiment, we should be with these things content, Paul said. And therefore, if we just want more luxury in our life and go out and borrow, I think we are basically in violation of some of that, some of those principles. That'd be my thoughts. Our next caller is Michael from Santee. Hi, Michael. Good to hear from you again.
Paul, thank you, sir. It's nice to talk to you. I want to let you know real quick that I do continue to pray for you and your family and your ministry, and even to the extent that I have my my phone set on alarm at 9:23 and 1:53, which is 7 minutes before both your programs. So, I'm at least praying for you twice a day.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I want to ask you about John 20. Verses 6 and 7 as they relate to what Peter and John saw, the linen cloths. And I recently came across a video on YouTube about the Shroud of Turin, and there was this guy that made a 3D image, computer graphic image, took that off the linen cloth, and it was a very fascinating video. But I want to ask you real quick, what is your opinion on the Shroud of Turin and also the Sudarium of Oviedo?
Now, I don't know about the second item. Would you tell me what that is first?
The Sudarium is the cloth that wrapped Jesus' face, his face, what they claim.
Okay.
And
is
it actually
preserved with the shroud?
It's they're in separate places. Sudarium, facial cloth, is in Oviedo, Spain. So they ended up in different places in the world.
Yeah, I don't know anything about the second of those. The Shroud, of course, everybody's heard of, and I've seen some documentaries on it and so forth. It seems to me that it's more of a scientific question to decide whether the Shroud as they have it is some kind of a hoax or whether it is really caused by supernatural power from a man, more or less the power of the resurrection imprinting on the Shroud something like a photographic image. It seems to me that almost all the studies I have observed seem to take a positive approach to it, that it is genuine. There are skeptics, of course, and I was initially a skeptic, still have a measure of skepticism, but I don't know. I don't want to say I know the Shroud to be genuine, because I simply don't. I don't have the scientific expertise to decide those things. And certainly there's nothing in the Bible that would tell us that the Shroud would be kept and would be, on display in the 21st century or anything like that. There's no reason biblically to believe it's authentic, but there may be some reasons scientifically to do so. I personally don't know enough about the meaning of the scientific tests that have been done on it to know. I will say that in general, my skepticism about it is less than it used to be. Just from what I've heard and read, I think it could well be the genuine Shroud of Christ, but I would never want to stake much money on it.
Okay, very good. Excellent. I can send you a link to that video, by the way. It was done by the History Channel, and they did an excellent job presenting this guy's work. in creating that.
It's possible that that's
3D image.
It's possible that that's one of the videos I've seen. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, the main thing that they were disputing was the carbon dating, and since then, even one of the main textile people has recanted and said that was a flawed test for many reasons.
Hmm.
So, okay,
right.
Thank
well,
you very much.
You know, I haven't really, you know, it's kind of interesting, but it's not interesting enough for me to really want to dig around and find out more about it, because the shroud has never really struck me as a necessary thing to decide.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
My faith in the resurrection or in Christ are not based on the shroud at all.
Yeah, it will be. Definitely. I'm wondering more, was it left here as a sign to unbelievers? Some people have gone to a point where they almost worship the thing, and I think that's gone too far. But as being a sign for unbelievers, I think it's very possible.
It could be. It could be. You know, I mean, some people have asked me if I think the Ark of Noah has been found or has been spotted or is likely to be found. And that's another thing. It's like the Shroud. I don't really care too much about the finding of the Ark. It wouldn't have any impact at all on my beliefs. I believe in the Ark 100% without knowing whether it's ever been found or ever will be found. And I've even said that even if they dismantled Mount Ararat pebble by pebble and didn't find the Ark there, it would not tell me that it had never been there. I mean, I know it was there because the Word of God says so. And that being so, finding the Ark wouldn't add to my confidence about it. And the same is true of the Shroud. I mean, it is interesting, and it could be that God does give occasion for unbelievers to see things like that confirm something in His Word. I would think believers wouldn't need that, but it's interesting, and it would be, you know, if they can ever prove beyond the shadow of a doubt that that's the Shroud of Jesus, it'd be nice to know, because at least we'd know what He looked like, you know, at least somewhat. Unfortunately, we're out of time, Michael. I appreciate your call and everyone who called. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We do this Monday through Friday for a half hour each weekday morning. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless.
Good morning. This has been today's The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg, a program that is reaching out to believers and non-believers alike, answering questions that you may have about the Bible, about your faith, and about your own spiritual quest. This is a very valuable service that Steve provides, and we're so glad to have him on the air here on KBright, and that's where we want him to stay, with his voice going out over Southern California. But that's up to you. It's up to you, the listeners, to be able to support this program and Steve's ministry. To do that, go to Steve's website, TheNarrowPath.com. Again, TheNarrowPath.com, and you'll see a place prominently displayed where you can give. And please give as generously as you can at TheNarrowPath.com. The views and opinions on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Crawford Broadcasting Company, its ownership, management, or its advertisers. Stay with us. Up next, it's Joyce Meyer on AM 740 KBright.
KBright is bringing you the 9th Annual Light at the Lighthouse Festival, a free day of fun for the entire family. From 10 a.m. to 6, Point Fermin Park in San Pedro will be filled with music from outstanding national and local performers, from gospel to rock, reggae to rap, Latin, pop, and jazz. There'll also be special stages for local rising stars and kids performing for kids, all free, all day, at the Light at the Lighthouse Festival. Come picnic in the park with us Labor Day Saturday at Point Fermin Park, San Pedro.
KBRT at KBRT HD Costa Mesa and on the web at KBRT740.com.
Welcome to Enjoying Everyday Life with New York Times bestselling author Joyce Meyer. On today's program, Joyce will be teaching from her series entitled Change. Do you feel stuck where you are right now? Maybe you desire a new job or want to find a fresh start somewhere new. Or are you looking for something more? You want to go deeper with God and change who you are, but are unsure how. God can provide many ways to change that is more than just a new job.
And in today's teaching, Joyce will share how you can gain the courage to choose change and be that much closer to Him. But before we start, I want to let you know that Joyce has a new book coming soon. The new title, God Is Not Mad at You, will be released September 3rd. You can pick it up wherever books are sold. Now, here's Joyce with today's teaching, Change.
I want to tell you something that God's been showing me lately that I think, hopefully and prayerfully, can really help you. I'm actually so excited about this, I'm going to write a book on it that hopefully will come out next spring. I believe that one of the reasons why people get so discouraged is because they don't take enough time to celebrate their victories. See, I think if you would ever just sit down, let's just say maybe you've been walking with God 5 years. Instead of getting up every morning and thinking about how far you have to go, why don't you spend a little time thinking about how far you've come? Come on. And then why don't you maybe take a day and just say, you know what, God, today I'm going to celebrate my progress. I mean, this is a day of celebration for me. You know what? I figured out the Israelites were party animals. I mean, they had a party every time they turned around. They would make a little bit of progress in the wilderness, and they'd stop and have a party. They'd build an altar and dance and get out their tambourines and shout and praise God. And it's refreshing to celebrate a little bit. And I think that God's been showing me that people don't celebrate enough. And you just get worn out with the trying and 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 the pushing and the pushing and the pushing.